Today's special episode of Undisclosed is brought to you by two great sponsors that really came through for us this week, Stamps.com and Blue Apron. We simply wouldn't have been able to put this content up without their support. So make sure you listen in later for information from Stamps.com and Blue Apron. Until then, enjoy the program.
I just want you guys to know that I got a call from Justin. I just got a call from Justin and it's not public. Don't say anything. We want a new trial. Judge Welch has given Adnan a new trial, and so don't say anything publicly. I just wanted to share the good news, and I'm just really overwhelmed, but I just wanted to let you guys know. Thank you for everything you've done. Thank you guys so much for everything you've done.
Hi and welcome to what is perhaps my most favorite episode yet of Undisclosed, Vacated. My name is Rabia Chaudhry, and what you just heard is the weepy, ugly, crying message I left our producers Dennis and Meethal right after I got a call from Justin last week telling me Adnan's conviction had been vacated and we got a new trial. This happened last Thursday on June 30th, and since then things have been really crazy. There's been tons of media coverage, lots of questions from people, and a 59-page opinion written by Judge Welch on all the issues raised at the PCR. Joining me today are my colleagues Susan Simpson, Colin Miller, and no other than our new addenda host, Emmy Award-winning actor, John Cryer. But before I turn the episode over to John to steer us through it all, we have to check in quickly with one of our beloved sponsors this week.
Many thanks, Rabia. Hey, listeners of Undisclosed, we are so, so excited to have Stamps.com back as a featured sponsor this season. The support that Stamps.com has given us for more than a year now has meant so much to us. And we're proud to tell our listeners that we use Stamps.com, and they should too. We use Stamps.com because we are busy. We're making two pieces of content per week. We're researching, we're writing, we're making brand new podcasts. On that, we'll tell you more later. And we're all still working our full-time day jobs. The truth is, sometimes it feels like there aren't enough hours in the day. There sure aren't enough hours in the day to try to visit the post office between 9 to 5, so why do it? If you're still making time-consuming trips to the post office, I am telling you, do what we at Undisclosed did, and that's find a better way. That better way? It's Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you get the postage you need the instant you need it. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package right from your computer and printer. And you save money doing it. Use Stamps.com, and that means you'll spend just a fraction of the cost of one of those expensive postage meters. Look, the Undisclosed team uses Stamps.com for all of our postage needs. And we have a lot of postage needs. The case that we've taken on for season two, it's nowhere near where any of us live. We end up mailing a lot of important investigative documents back and forth, and we use Stamps.com to do it. So do what the Undisclosed team did. Sign up for Stamps.com and use our promo code UNDISCLOSED for this special offer. You'll get a 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer that includes postage and a digital scale. Go get that bonus offer. Seriously. Pause the podcast, go to Stamps.com, get the bonus, and come back and join us. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in UNDISCLOSED. That's Stamps.com and enter UNDISCLOSED. All right, team, you're back up. Go get them.
All right, back to you guys.
Thanks, Rabia. I'm sure this has been an amazing, amazing couple of days for you. And I know that I'm going to be asking you a million questions because, events are overtaking us. And I know you've actually answered a lot of these questions before, so please forgive me. I think everybody who was concerned with the Adnan case had the same reaction I did, which was, "Oh wow, this is amazing that this happened." And you know what ensued was obviously a firestorm of jubilation all over the internet, which was wonderful to see. In the midst of that, though, I also felt real sadness because as a parent. I can't even begin to imagine the pain of losing your child and the horror of what Heyman Lee's family has had to go through all these years. So I just wanted to communicate that I'm sure that if there were a way for Adnan to get a fair trial without Hay's family ever experiencing another moment of pain, you know, that every one of the people who have supported efforts on behalf of Adnan would choose that.
Of course.
But, you know, this is the criminal justice system. So I understand their anger and I understand their pain, and my heart breaks for them. But at the same time, I believe the police made a terrible error in prosecuting Adnan. So can I ask you, can I get to where were you when you actually got the news?
Oh, you know what? I was home alone. My husband and daughter had just gone out. They had errands to run. And Justin, so what Justin's been doing for the last couple of weeks, every time he has to call me, he sends me a message saying, there's no news, but I'm going to call you. because I get so like nervous and excited. And the phone started ringing and it was him and he hadn't sent me a message. And I was like, something is up. So I picked it up and he told me and I was loud and hysterical and sobbing. And I think then I sent immediately a message to Susan Colin, like on email. And then Susan called me and she got a really horrible version of me sobbing and screaming too. and then I just started calling people and then the firestorm happened. But I was home alone for hours and I was dying. I was like, I need a hug. I need somebody here. But I was
Mr. Beans. Mr. Beans wasn't enough.
He wasn't helping. No, he
no,
wasn't
I'm
helping.
Sorry.
What about you guys? Susan, Colin, where were you guys when I sent you the message?
I actually didn't get your email. I was working on the season 2 script, and literally I saw it on Twitter for the first time, and I picked up my phone to call my wife, and she actually called me the second before and hadn't heard the news, and I was like, oh my God, I just saw on Twitter that Nan got a new trial. So yeah, it was just a complete shock out of the blue.
And Susan, where were you?
I was in a meeting with a client.
Which I'm sure got a little strange very quickly.
I started dancing in my seat and high-fiving the coworker.
Which is unprofessional in that kind of circumstance.
I'm sure your client understood, though.
He did. He was, we explained what was going on after.
What struck me was how quickly the media had to be corrected that it wasn't Serial that got him this new trial. That in fact it was the work of the Undisclosed team, and with a special emphasis on Susan. I was immediately tweeting, going, "Wait a minute, guys! Wait a minute! Let's remember who found this bit of cell tower evidence that was so important."
Yeah, you know, this question comes up over and over again, and I've answered it like a million different times. And I mean, it's as simple as this: none of this could have happened. Not just without Serial, but also without like Susan Collin and others investigating. Like it took everybody. It's not there's so much credit to go around to so many people. It's not exclusive to just one party. But in this case, I mean, hello. Yeah, it was the facts cover sheet. And so props to Susan. That was Susan, period.
And of course, the big question that I know you've already answered on the media, but I'd like to know, has Adnan heard and what was his reaction?
Oh, so what happened was Adnan was apparently, I mean, the prison has been, they had a couple people were killed and like stabbed last week and the prison went on lockdown. Then they, the other inmates, they put them on every other day phone schedules. So I had just spoken to him the day before on Wednesday, and Thursday when the news broke, he didn't have phone privileges. On Friday, he called me twice. I missed the calls. He called his family twice. They missed the calls. Then he finally called his lawyer. And he did speak to Justin. And he had heard at the prison and from just the news and others, the guards and stuff. So I'm hoping, I don't know if he has privileges on the weekend now, but we'll see if I hear from him. We haven't spoken yet.
Oh, this is driving me crazy.
It's a little frustrating, yeah.
So when I first heard the news, I immediately tried to go online and actually find the ruling. And I couldn't find the ruling. I found the order. And when I found the order, I was surprised that it seemed it didn't sound particularly promising at first.
Right.
Because I was reading down the course of it that the counsel's alleged ineffective assistance of counsel was denied. The withholding potentially exculpatory evidence, the Brady violation, was denied. But then finally you get to that second page and that it says alleged ineffective assistance for failure to cross-examine the state's cell tower expert about the reliability of cell tower location evidence is hereby granted and the order is vacated. Now, okay, please explain to us what exactly does vacated mean?
Vacated is legal speak for reversed or erased. It's essentially saying that jury determination of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt no longer stands. It's as if we're back in 1999 or 2000 and Adnan has been charged with a crime but has not yet been convicted. So we're back to square one. The presumption of innocence is returned, and we move on from there.
So if the presumption of innocence goes back to Adnan, it means that the burden of proof goes back to the state. They have to prove it again.
Right. They have the burden of proof in either getting Judge Welch's opinion overturned, or should this be a new trial, as opposed to them appealing this reversal at trial, they would have to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt all over again.
So as I was reading this order, I thought, well, this is interesting because, as I said, it doesn't sound particularly promising for Adnan. But then when you read the actual ruling, which is 59 pages of fascinating stuff, it comes down very, very hard on the state. In fact, I looked up what the reaction of the Attorney General of Maryland, Thiru Vagnaraja, was, and he stated, it is in the continued desire of the Attorney General to seek justice in the murder of Heyman Lee. The court ruled in the state's favor on a number of issues, but there does appear to be at least one ground that will need to be resolved by the appellate courts. The state's responsibility remains to pursue justice and to defend what it believes is a valid conviction. That seemed delusional to me. I was like, did he not read it?
Most of it was pretty predictable PR speech, but that one line about how most of the rulings were in our favor, or however he put it, it definitely crosses the line from PR and borderline. It's denial, basically, because that's not what happened.
Maybe he didn't read the opinion at that point. I just wonder. Because it actually, that statement, I think, came out like pretty quickly, like a couple of hours after the news broke. And I was like, maybe he didn't read the opinion? I don't know.
Well, let's go through it. What surprised me was that the order makes it sound like Asia McClain's testimony didn't change anything for Judge Welch. But the ruling doesn't seem to say that, does it, Colin?
Yeah, well, what's interesting, going back to what Thiru said in his statement, is that Judge Welch very much credits Asia's testimony, finds it credible that she saw him until 2:40, and the only reason he doesn't reverse on Asia is what he says is Jay's story is lacking in credibility, the state's timeline is all screwed up. Everything before that Lincoln Park burial was basically meaningless. The state's case was so weak that an alibi witness being added wouldn't have changed things. And then he gets into the cell tower pings and goes into how those were unreliable. But right, it's not a reaffirmation of what the state showed at trial. It's very much dismantling it and saying that's the only reason why I'm not going to grant relief based upon Asia's testimony.
So basically what you're saying is that the judge is saying that he believes Asia. He's not doubting her veracity. He believes she probably saw him, but that it might not have necessarily been helpful to Adnan if the state had moved their timeline around. Is that what you're saying?
Right, because his point is every part of Jay's story up until the Lincoln Park pings, it contradicts the cell tower pings. He contradicts himself. He contradicts the state's timeline. So his point is essentially the jury already saw that Jay's story did not match the records, did not match the state's narrative. And so as such, adding Asia to the table, although important, wouldn't have been enough to change things because it was really the corroboration of Jay's burial story with the Lincoln Park pings that led to the jury convicting Adnan.
Yeah, this is probably one of the areas that I had the most disagreement with the decision, because it seemed like Judge Welch just assumed or took it for granted that the jury must have realized that Jay's stories from 2 to 4 p.m. were just bogus,
right?
And therefore decided that they couldn't have played a part in their decision. And since the jury clearly didn't care about what Jay was saying from 2 to 4 p.m., evidence about what happened from 2 to 4 p.m. was meaningless. And I think that's wrong on two fronts. First, that you can't really assume the jury actually realized this, because the way stuff was presented, there was never a clear timeline, never a clear sequence of events, and it is very possible the jury never actually realized that Jay's statements were impossible, because Gutierrez certainly didn't highlight it. And the other part that didn't quite seem right to me is that we're not just dealing with Jay here. There was other evidence. For instance, there's evidence that Hay left the school at 2:25 p.m. from Innes Butler. So it doesn't matter what Jay is saying. If the victim left the area where the defendant was before the murder occurred, that is an alibi, and that's pretty strong evidence.
in my mind, it looks like the ruling just totally decimates everything that Jay has to say, and takes that as though the jury would automatically understand that. But obviously that wasn't the case in the second trial. And it seemed like a puzzling omission on the part of Judge Welch to me.
I agree. He started from the assumption that Jay's story was totally bogus, except for the tiny part from 7 o'clock to 7:30. So, yeah.
Although I will add this in the sense, if we go back to the first trial, the prosecution presented its entire case, including Jay. The only thing they didn't present was the cell tower evidence and Jen. And you might recall that one of Adnan's initial bail attorneys talked to the jurors after that mistrial, and the jurors were saying they didn't believe Jay, that the state had no case. So at least there is some support out there that Jay, without the cell tower pings, is disregarded. Now, of course, the second trial went a little bit differently than the first trial, but I can at least see some of the logic in the judge's ruling. But I think there's actually some important precedent that's come out recently that would change the way this outcome would have come down and might change the Court of Appeals of Maryland in ruling on it.
Judge Welch also denied the Brady violation, which didn't surprise me because I didn't at first I was unaware that the defense actually had the facts cover sheet, but did not use it or did not pay enough attention to it. But when I had listened to Undisclosed, for some reason, at first I got the impression that the prosecution had withheld that piece of evidence. But it does appear that it was in the file. So it seemed reasonable to me that he would deny that Brady violation. Would that be correct?
That's an issue that was not highlighted extensively in the hearing. So I understand entirely why he reached that conclusion, because having a very deep technical dive into the records could have very easily lost everyone's attention and probably wouldn't advance the case much. So I get why the judge ruled that way. And the case was always going to be Brady or Strickland. Withholding evidence or ineffective assistance. It couldn't be both. So he was always going to rule against one of those.
I just want to quickly explain to our listeners what you're saying. So basically, you know, Susan found this fax cover sheet, which had not been shown to the cell phone expert back during the trial in 2000. And so the question is, was the fax cover sheet not shown because either Gutierrez didn't have it because the state withheld it from her, and that's a Brady violation, or she had it and she didn't use it, and that's ineffective assistance of counsel, which leads to the Strickland analysis. So I just want to sprinkle that in.
What we are talking about in our episodes is the fact that the copy, so there's a fax cover sheet that the defense did have, but it was the cover sheet that came with a set of cell phone records that never played any role in the trial. They were for Yasser, another friend of Anand's. They weren't introduced at trial. They weren't used in any fashion. They had essentially no relevance to the case. And she did have the AT&T cover sheet that came with those. For me, the Brady violation comes from the fact that there is no reasonable way that Gutierrez could have figured out that cover sheet that was with different records altogether actually applied to a different set of records that were cropped, had all the fax headers removed from them, had no trace of being a fax remaining, and were presented in a cropped form at the hearing for the first time in that way. So I think, and that was not something that Justin stressed in his hearing or went into great detail on, so it's not something that I think the judge missed so much as it wasn't really a part of this hearing. But based on what's in the record, I don't think there's a reasonable way that Gutierrez, assuming that she did not get another copy from the prosecution or the prosecution didn't have one in their file and she couldn't look at it, I don't see how she could have made the mental jump from that one sheet for the Yasser records to the Exhibit 31 records. Does that make any sense at all?
Yes, that absolutely made sense. People often wonder how lawyers deal with just the blizzard of information that they get, because it's an enormous amount of work just downloading it, just taking it into your mind. And so I think that's one of the reasons that they give lawyers just enormous leeway in terms of saying, well, they did their best. You know, it's just so much to remember. Obviously, in Gutierrez's case, she was dealing with a lot of other things as well. I just want to point out another of my favorite parts of the ruling, which was when Judge Welch actually took apart Thiru's theory on Asia and her letters. This is one of my favorites. It says, in order to reach the state's conclusion, however, the court would have to assume that it was highly unlikely that McLean could have obtained the information from other sources, which is an assumption that is contrary to the facts. Again, there's so many areas of what Thero presented in the PCR hearing that the judge just absolutely tears apart. Another one. Here's another one. He went to town on Agent Fitzgerald. The court is perplexed by Agent Fitzgerald's interpretation of Exhibit 31 that are cell detail records and not a subscriber activity report. Agent Fitzgerald also contradicted his own testimony. It just absolutely tears Agent Fitzgerald a new one, which is obscure legal parlance, I realize.
I remember walking out of the hearing during Fitzgerald's testimony and going online and seeing what reporters were saying about the case. And I was just like, wait, did we just come out of the same courtroom? Is that what y'all saw in there? Because they were saying, oh, the state's expert has rejected the claims of the defense and like has explained why, rah, 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 rah. And I'm like, that didn't happen. Like, where were y'all hearing this? So I was kind of concerned that the judge was hearing the same thing the reporters were. Because to me, it seemed blatantly clear that that Fitzgerald was straight up contradicting himself without regard for like what he said previously. He was changing his story to fit the moment and was not prepared in any fashion to talk about the details here and was giving basically a off the cuff, here's what I think happened, probably maybe, sort of deal. But it seems like Judge Welch was in the same courtroom I was because he saw the same thing.
Yeah, and John, going back to the burden of proof that I mentioned before, all of these things you're mentioning, Fitzgerald contradicting himself, Asia being credible, those are all factual findings. And the only way the Maryland appellate courts would reverse those is for abuse of discretion if they find that Judge Welch abused his discretion in making these conclusions. That almost never happens because Judge Welch was in the courtroom. He got to see Asia testify. He got to see Fitzgerald testify. There are other legal conclusions. Was this ineffective assistance? Was this a Brady violation? That's reviewed. It's called de novo, which means the appellate court is free to apply its own logic and analysis. But those factual conclusions you just mentioned, those are exceedingly unlikely for the appellate court to reverse what the judge found with regard to those.
Well, that's one thing I wanted to ask you, Colin, was, let's put yourself in the place. Let's say you're the Attorney General of Maryland. You're a smart guy. You don't really care whether they're the person who's in jail is guilty or not. You just want to defend the state's the judge's verdict in the first trial. So how would you go about appealing this? I'm just putting you in that position, Colin. Obviously, you have different feelings.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complete high wire act here because going back to what I said before, the judge's conclusion is Gutierrez was fundamentally incompetent and unreasonable in failing to contact Asia. And the only reason that didn't lead to a new trial was because the crux of the state's case was this intersection between Jay's testimony, the Lincoln Park pings, and the burial. So Thero or whoever can't go to the appellate court and say, well, actually, the cell tower pings weren't important. You should reverse. That's not grounds for a new trial. If he does that, that means Asia's a winning argument. I think the only thing really that they can claim on appeal is procedural, that the statute of limitations ran, that there was waiver, and therefore Judge Welch shouldn't even have heard the ineffective assistance of counsel issue with regard to the cell towers.
That would be a tough argument. Sorry, yeah. I was going to say, Colin, can you explain that a little bit about the waiver and statute, like exactly you mean by that?
Yeah, so the way it works in Maryland is you have 10 years from your final direct appeal of the verdict to file for collateral or post-conviction relief. So direct appeal is based upon errors from the trial record. Collateral appeal is based upon errors not evident from the trial record. And Adnan, of course, did not challenge the cell tower records in his initial appeal within that 10-year time frame. What Judge Welch said, though, was actually cited to a case called Gutierrez. It's not the same Gutierrez from this case. But what he said is the only way Adnan could have waived this issue procedurally is if he knowingly and intelligently waived it. And what Gutierrez and other cases say is you can only knowingly and intelligently waive it if you have things such as your appellate counsel telling you you should raise this and you don't, you have a high level of education, et cetera. And Judge Welch essentially said this is a case where you have a kid. He was arrested when he hadn't graduated from high school. He was never told about this issue. And immediately when they learned of it and heard from Warnowitz in this case, they raised the issue. And as such, they found even though the 10 years had passed, it was okay to raise the issue. I think that's a pretty safe conclusion, but if I were the attorney general, that's the one thing I would try to attack. And I'm not personally sure. I haven't done an exhaustive search of sort of tolling the statute of limitations in Maryland. I'm not sure if there's case law that's helpful to the state there.
And that's another example, though, of how, I mean, Justin put on a great case, and the defense did an excellent job in covering all its bases, being prepared. But there was an assist from a lot of unforced errors on the state's part, and the state bringing this up on its own in the briefing was one of them. If they went out of their way to make this part of their defense or their case for the PCR, then I think that, assuming there is any merit to the argument of waiver here, I mean, they reopened it. They're the ones who put it before the court.
Yeah, and John, actually, I'd be curious to hear your take. What Susan's referencing is the fact that in their appellate brief, the state attorney general's office said, well, age is not a big deal. Yeah, we claimed at trial the come-and-get-me call was 236, but we just as easily could have claimed the 3:15 p.m. call was the come-and-get-me call, and that doesn't show the weakness of our case. It just shows we had flexibility. Had you seen that footnote before? And I'm wondering, as a non-lawyer, what your take on that argument was.
As a non-lawyer, it smells like bullshit. it smells like, you know, we could have gone a bunch of different ways on this. But my understanding is that you can't, actually. You have to present a sort of unified theory of what exactly occurred. It doesn't pass the smell test for me.
Well, from that footnote to a footnote in this opinion, which is footnote 9, that's getting a lot of play, I think it's important to kind of cover how the judge kind of responds to that argument.
Basically, Judge Welch sort of does his own version of the drive test, where he says, okay, well, wait a second. You're saying the 3:15 p.m. call could have been the come and get me call. And yet at trial, you're claiming there's a call at 3:21 p.m. that is Jay calling Jen. Let me break this down. So you say you get the come and get me call at 3:15. You then drive from the Pusateri residence to Best Buy. Adnan does the trunk pop. You then drive over to the park and ride. You look at the body some more. You readjust some things. You then go and drive up to the Forest Park golf course to buy some weed. And only at that point are you making that call to Jen Pusateri. And it's sort of ridiculous because this would take well over half an hour. And the state's claiming we could have fit this into a 6-minute timeline. So, yeah, he's essentially calling it out and saying, no, you're making this up. There's no way this call would have worked at trial.
Not to mention, by the way, this is a ridiculous theory of the crime. He said, if you've just killed somebody in the parking lot of a public place in daylight hours, how do you have time to put the body in the trunk before your friend arrives with his car? And, you know, it beggars belief, and it always did. But it surprised me that the judge actually laid it out in this manner in this ruling. Is that typical?
I think it explains exactly why the judge reached the decision he did. For him, it just didn't seem plausible that anyone had believed Jay's story. My take is this footnote, it explains why he says Asia wouldn't have, you know, met the prejudice prong, because of course no one believed Jay. Everyone knows everything Jay said before that time was total perplexion. So for him, it was easier to discount the defense that they could have raised at the 236 time period, because basically he couldn't insult the jury by assuming they'd believe Jay in the first place.
Footnote 9 was great, but there's another footnote we're going to look at, and that's footnote 10. We'll do that right after we check in with another important sponsor, Blue Apron.
Thanks, Robbie. So, you know, last week you busted my chops pretty good about not cooking. Well, guess what? I went out and I fixed that problem. I'm not taking your guff anymore. How's that, you ask? Well, it's because I went out and I got Blue Apron. Yeah, so Rabia, who's the master chef now? Do you know why I got Blue Apron? Other than the fact that I'm tired of your culinary dominance, it's because I also care about a more sustainable food system. I care about high standards for ingredients. I care about being part of a community of home chefs who use seafood that's sourced sustainably, beef that's raised humanely, pork that's raised naturally, and chickens that are raised free range. All that stuff's important to me. Not only that, but I use Blue Apron because it's simple to use, and it comes right to my door in Baltimore. Blue Apron can be delivered to 99% of the continental U.S. and 99.5% of food deserts. I get the food, I cook it, I eat it, and I don't waste a bite. That's because Blue Apron ships the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe that I need. And doing that reduces food waste. You want to know what else it reduces? The hit my bank account usually takes by eating out so much. You can spend 10 bucks or less per person for a healthy, delicious meal from Blue Apron. You spend 10 bucks, but I swear it's like you're getting a $20 meal. You absolutely have to check out what Blue Apron is offering this July. They've got spinach and basil pesto gnocchi with summer squash, green beans, fresh mozzarella spiced pork tacos with avocado and pickled onion, and elote-style corn summer vegetable pizza with garlic lemon broccolini. So Undisclosed fans, listen, here's the bottom line. Not all ingredients are created equal. Fresh, high-quality ingredients taste better, and they're better for you. So it's important to know where your food comes from. Blue Apron knows that when you cook with incredible ingredients, you make incredible meals. So they set the highest quality standards for their community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. You're doing your palate, your stomach, and your health a disservice by eating anything else. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/undisclosed. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, better way to cook.
Yeah, it's kind of sort of an irony in the court's decision. Yes, he did rule against non-legally on the Asia issue, but he couldn't have done much more to write a better set of facts to set him up on appeal, basically, because the factual findings are better than I would have guessed for a ruling that found in his favor on that issue. So factually, I mean, yes, the state is going to appeal, but they're basically setting themselves up to get knocked down for a cross appeal.
Well, also, Colin, you mentioned something in a blog post about that there's actually been another ruling in the Supreme Court that would have an effect on this, that it actually came down while Judge Welch was considering his opinion, that it would have some effect on the appeal.
Yeah, this is a case the Supreme Court decided about a month after the hearing. It was Weary versus Cain, and some of the facts might sound very similar to listeners to this case. It's a case out of Louisiana, and Michael Weary was convicted of murdering Eric Walber. It was between 8:20 and 9:30 p.m. on April 4th, 1998. And sort of the J of the case was Sam Scott. He came forward and said Weary committed the murder, but then he changed his story about the events about five times. He wasn't corroborated by any evidence that had to do anything with the murder. And Weary actually had an alibi, like Asia McLean. He said he was at a wedding reception, but there was conflicting testimony. It was unclear whether he left the reception in time to commit the murder. What Scott had, though, in addition to his conflicting stories, was he claimed later that night he was driving in the victim's car with Weary. And in fact, that was corroborated by other witnesses who saw Weary driving the car that night. And this was a Brady case. It was the state failing to disclose certain evidence, such as Weary having a grudge against Scott. In fact, he said to another inmate he was going to make sure that Weary gets the needle because he jacked me over. And so this was March 7th. The opinion came down was all about proving prejudice. And prejudice is the same for Brady as it is for ineffective assistance. And here's sort of the key point. It goes directly to what Judge Welch was addressing. And it's probably something he didn't see because it wasn't part of the briefings. It didn't come until after the PCR. But what the majority of the court said was the corroboration here of Scott's story about the car at most would have proven that Weary was an accessory after the fact. In other words, it wouldn't have proved that Weary killed the victim. It would have simply proved he was in possession of the car hours later. And it's basically the same thing here. Judge Welch is saying, we don't care about Jay's conflicting stories, the alibi, etc., because that's not corroborated. What the state still had was the corroboration of the Lincoln Park pings. But what Weary pretty strongly says is, you're going to have prejudice if the only remaining evidence leads to discussions of after the murder events. And so just as Lincoln Park pings in Adnan's case, in my opinion, are not enough to prove murder, in the Weary case, he was saying driving the car hours later was not enough to prove murder, just accessory. So I think Justin Brown on appeal, or at least cross appeal, should the state appeal in this case, would strongly cite to Weary and its strong precedent to show prejudice has been proven based upon the Asia alibi.
So Thiru at this point has a really tough choice in front of him. But I imagine that he's probably scared of a new trial. I have to figure, being that all of the evidence has been dismantled. So, but I imagine an appeal is actually the easiest course of action for him at this time. Would that be right?
If he wants to delay, yeah.
Well, no, I know it's morally reprehensible, of course, but I'm sure the expense and an embarrassment of a new trial for him, for him, delaying action might be the only thing that would be a way for him to save face, which is a horrible thing to do in this particular set of circumstances.
He's got to figure out what his end game is here. Does he actually believe he's going to win an appeal? If he does, then he should do that. Like that's what he should do. It's ethical. That's what he needs to be doing here. I think he could come to the conclusion that there are viable ways there. But the alternative reason for doing that is to drag this out for years and gain leverage for forcing a plea.
I'm glad you brought up that subject, because what types of pleas could be available now? I've seen a lot of mentions of an Alford plea at this point, and I'm sorry, please forgive me. I don't remember what an Alford plea actually is.
An Alford plea is actually pretty common in cases like this where, you know, you have a situation where it's kind of a rock and a hard place for both the defendant and the state. The state doesn't want to go back to trial. Like, so in this situation, right, there's a couple of options here. The state can say, okay, he got a new trial. Let's give it to him. Or they can say, we're going to appeal this, keep fighting it. And you know what? Maybe the higher courts will grant the appeal. Maybe they will overturn this decision. Or maybe they'll just say, no, we affirm it, and he gets a new trial. So once they're up against the wall and they have no choice but to go to trial, it could be years from now if they drag this out, they could say, well, you know what? We know we're not going to win at trial. So what we'll do is we'll offer you something called an Alford plea. An Alford plea allows the defendant to maintain their innocence while taking a guilty plea. And that's predicated on kind of this understanding of, I mean, I don't think most defendants who take the plea believe it, but the fact that defendants are like the position is that I maintain my innocence, but I admit that the state has enough to convict me. Now, if the state had enough to convict them, they would probably go back to trial. But usually they don't, which is why they offered this plea. So it's kind of this weird construction. So it happened in the West Memphis 3 case. It happens in a lot of these kinds of cases. And they'll plea out usually time served and close the case. And that's kind of the tragedy of it, is that everybody just walks away. The defendant is considered still criminally liable, like that person is still a felon and they're responsible for that crime because it's a guilty plea. The investigation is not reopened. But a lot of people end up taking it because the alternative is, if they say we're not going to take it, we're going to go to trial, you know, well, you're back up. You know, you're rolling the dice again. You don't know what the state's going to come with, you know, from jailhouse snitch to new evidence to anything. And also, you're gonna spend another few years in prison.
So realistically, that's a thing that a lot of inmates take just because they don't want to go through the torture of the waiting, really.
Okay, yeah, and the thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars for a trial. I mean, Adnan is doing, I guess, okay in that regard. Robbie probably knows a bit more, but I mean, in most cases of the wrongfully convicted, there's just no way they have the money and the resources to be able to challenge a retrial.
Someday, Colin, you'll have to explain to me how the Alford plea came to be, because it just sounds like such a bizarre straddling of guilt and innocence.
Oh, and a lot of judges won't take them. Yeah, we can go into more detail later, but it's a Supreme Court case, North Carolina versus Alford, a case out of North Carolina, because the point is this: to have a valid guilty plea, it has to be knowing, intelligent, voluntary. And the fourth part is it has to be based upon a proper factual predicate. We don't want a person being convicted if they're saying, I stabbed the victim and it was a gunshot wound. And the way around that in the Alford case is for the court to say, well, it's okay for a defendant to say, prosecution has these facts and this evidence, and I acknowledge they could have proven my guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. I'm not going to admit to any facts. I'm not going to admit to guilt, but here's the proper factual predicate, and you can consider what the prosecutor's saying.
So what is the bail situation? Because since the ruling has been vacated, I'm seeing a lot of questions on social media saying, well, if he's, for all intents and purposes, innocent at this point, shouldn't bail be a real possibility for him?
I mean, theoretically, I mean, it depends on how things play out in the next month or so. But say the state decided to charge him and go back to retrial, he would be entitled to ask for bail. And it's not a majority of murder defendants and murder pending murder cases don't get bail, but it happens. It's not something that's like never, ever going to happen, or it's like a 99% chance not. Like, it happens. If you have good reasons and a good explanation for why it's deserved here, there is, that is available. And Adnan has excellent reasons to argue for the court that yes, he should be granted bail. And while this is either pending retrial or pending for appeal, he should be released.
Would the fact that he had never committed a violent act before he was put in prison and has not in the 17 years that he's been in prison come into play?
That's one of the factors they consider, is the possible risk that might be posed. And in that case, there'd be very, very little, I think, the state could argue, for at least for that ground in particular, that would argue in favor of keeping bail, or denying bail, sorry.
The purpose of bail is to ensure the defendant returns to stand trial. In a case like this, with somebody who's so high profile, it's very unlikely that, you know, somebody like Adnan is going to abscond and not show up for trial. And the other thing is, one of the other factors that is considered and was considered in 1999 was community support. Although it didn't work in his favor then, we hope that that would work in his favor now. One of the big considerations behind the scenes, as we're talking about this, I'm discussing it with Justin and family and how to do this, is the fact that, you know what, we expect the bail to be set at a very, very high level, like $1 million to $1.5 million is what we are thinking. And that's another consideration.
Well, I just got a Twitter question from Yorkset saying, is there anything we as a community can do now to help with getting bail?
Yeah, I think once the decision is made to move on that, and I'm getting a sense from Justin right now that we're kind of waiting to see what the state does, right? The ball is in their court. If, you know, just because they released that statement, which seemed to indicate they're going to appeal it, we don't know for sure they're going to appeal it. I think that there's still a possibility, just a possibility, they might even now say, well, we're done with it. So I think we're waiting a little bit to see what the state does with it before we move forward. And I really appreciate that tweet. And obviously, if we have to raise money for the bail, everybody will know and hopefully people can help.
So at this point, Justin Brown has to prepare either for an appeal or for a brand new trial. Obviously, a brand new trial is an enormous undertaking. What steps could they take now to prepare?
I mean, I think preparations have been ongoing. I mean, everything that even Susan and Colin have been and others have been investigating in the last year are part of these preparations. There are more things behind the scenes that, you know, there's more evidence and issues, I think, that are very helpful in the case that are being kept under wraps right now in case there's a new trial and we're going to raise it then. So the preparation has been ongoing. And I don't know. I mean, about a new trial, I guess it's maybe a good idea right now to kind of explore how the state could possibly even win at a new trial. I mean, like, Colin, Susan, what do you guys, or any John, what do you guys think? I mean, like, what could they bring at a new trial that could actually work here?
This is why part of me kind of secretly wishes that there is a retrial, just to the chaos.
Watch it burn.
I mean, it would be like, it'd be, it's not funny, but it's kind of funny. Because I don't know what they'd do. I feel sorry for whoever gets that job, if it does come to that, for the state side. Because, there's not many options, and none of them are good.
At this point, it would have to be new evidence. They would have to somehow produce something new for them to do it. Because there is nothing left of the old. There's nothing. I can't think of anything.
They need something new. It's not a new Jay story.
Yes, exactly. he's had plenty of news stories. I would be fascinated to see Jay as a witness, because I'd love to see if he brought in any of the new elements from the story that he told in The Intercept, which entailed a midnight burial, which doesn't comport to the cell phone records, which has no trunk pop at the Best Buy parking lot. I don't know how in any way that integrates to what they presented.
And, by the way, in which he says he wasn't even there at the burial. Like, he didn't see her being buried. So there's that, too.
Oh, I forgot that.
Yeah. And, John, that speaks to what you said before, which is that their chances on appeal are actually much better, because the appeal is a time capsule. We're assuming that things that existed at trial are still the case now. But as you say, we have this new Intercept interview by Jay. We know there was no wrestling match on January 13th. We have the lividity evidence. If there's a new trial, there's going to be a subpoena of the Crime Stoppers information. There's new witnesses we have heard from, new witnesses that we have heard from and other people haven't heard from. It's just a new trial would be it's hard to imagine the state piecing together any type of coherent narrative that would make any type of sense to a Baltimore jury.
You know, a lot of people keep asking, I mean, I've gotten this Twitter question over and over, and I'm sure you guys have too, about, like, if there's a new trial, like, who could be called as witnesses? And the thing is, everybody can be called as witnesses. You know, Jay, Jen, Dawn, I think, you know, it's, you're starting all over.
Now, one question I've been getting a lot is people trying to figure out, and this is obviously because they all understand what torture it must be for Ananda to be in jail during all of this. In terms of possible timelines, in terms of if there is an appeal, do we have any idea how long that might take? And if that got turned over and on appeal, a new trial was ordered, obviously we have no idea how long that would take. But do you guys have any possible projection for people who are curious?
3 years. Yeah. You know, I think notwithstanding something as drastic as the state just kind of dropping it or offering a plea right now, I think we're in it for a couple of more years at least.
Yeah, I would say probably 6 months to a year for the Court of Special Appeals to rule, another 6 months to a year for the Court of Appeals, Maryland's highest court, to rule. If there's a new trial, we're talking probably at least another 6 months to a year. The interesting thing we haven't mentioned yet, and I haven't actually said this to Ravia or Susan or Justin yet, is we've been talking about how great a lot of Judge Welch's findings are. There's the possibility, assuming for some reason the Maryland state courts reversed and found no new trial, the findings here of Judge Welch would allow for Adnan to seek a new trial in federal court based upon a finding of actual innocence, which is that no reasonable jury could have found him guilty based upon not only the trial evidence, but everything else discovered. You add up the cell tower disclaimer, Asia, some of the other evidence. Again, if for whatever reason, which I don't think it'll happen, the Maryland courts deny him a new trial, there is ample room for a federal appeal at this point.
Sorry, you just blew my mind, Colin, to think that this might go to a whole other level. I have to hope that the Attorney General considers that when he proceeds, because I don't believe the taxpayers of Maryland should have to pay for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one thing that I try to remind folks is that, you know, when this happens so often in these kinds of cases that where the state can afford to keep appealing and they'll fight it. They fight and fight and fight to hold their conviction until their backs are up against the wall. But it is on the taxpayer dime. In a situation like this, I guess this is a question I'll pose for Susan and Colin. You guys have experienced litigation. Is how likely do you think it is that that COSA would reverse Judge Welch's findings? I mean, I'm curious.
I think it's totally possible by the time we're done, Anand gets freed on the Asia issue and the cell phone issue somehow, for some reason, gets reversed. I mean, it's totally possible that at the end it'd be the total opposite of what we have now.
Because if the state appeals, what I understand, if the state appeals the issue that they lost, which is the cell tower issue, then we can cross appeal on the Asia issue, right?
Yeah. And the facts there are very strong for Anand.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's going to be a 3-judge panel. So it's not all the judges in the Court of Special Appeals. It's a 3-judge panel, and a lot depends on the proclivities and the inclinations of those particular judges. There is a possibility they could reverse. I think that it's unlikely, but as Susan says, it's very possible they could reverse in the cell tower issue and grant relief on the Asia issue, especially with this new Weary precedent. So remote. Maybe 10 to 20% chance they reverse, but it's a possibility.
Colin, do you know if it's the same panel that sent the decision back down to Judge Welch?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know it was initially assigned they were going to have a hearing, last June, before they remanded. I'm not sure if it's the same 3 judges. Justin would probably know if it's the same 3 judges as last year. I haven't researched them at all to see their judging history.
And another question folks have asked is, if it goes to trial, is it going to be with Judge Welch? No, it's not. He's retired, so...
Now, wasn't Judge Welch the same guy who denied the first PCR?
He was. And, credit to him for being able to. I mean, overall, I thought his opinion was great. He clearly was paying close attention. He researched the heck out of it. He wanted to make sure he covered all his bases. And each point is meticulously researched, cited. So it's a great opinion. But he also explained his reasoning and his fact finding explains why his decision now is different from what it was back in, 2014? And I mean, for one, it's kind of easy in one regard, is that he hadn't seen Asia before. Now he's seen Asia, and that is a strong reason for him to change his opinion, given that before all he had was Yurik's representations about her.
Which leads me to maybe my only point of frustration is that I don't think Yurik got any treatment at all in this. And so the smackdown that I've been praying for a couple of years now is probably not going to happen. I think he's become kind of a non-issue in this case.
That's footnote 10. Yeah.
I actually received a Twitter question from somebody asking if Yurik would be reinstated as a prosecutor if it went back to a retrial. And I don't believe that would happen, right? Because he's in private practice now, isn't he?
That's right. Yep.
So it would be very unlikely.
Yeah. And I also agree with the judge here. Like, so basically footnote 10 says Asia refuted what Yurik said previously, but there wasn't a need for the court to go farther. And I understand for a lot of good reasons, it made sense for the judge not to go there when he didn't have to.
So can I ask you, what can COSA go there?
No. I mean, I don't. Maybe.
We want to give you hope, Rabia. That's what we're.
I'd be surprised. For.
Yeah, I just want a little bit of public disciplinary language for this guy.
Yes, it's hard to hope for that without hoping for a retrial, because then in retrial maybe you could put him on the stand. That would be fun.
I am still disappointed we didn't get that PCR hearing. That would have been great.
Get him on the stand at the PCR hearing?
Yeah.
Yeah. That would have been the time, really, I think, to get him down. I mean, I assume at a retrial he might not be relevant because it's like starting all over, like he never happened. He didn't intervene with Asia not making it to the PCR.
There's between 5 and 10 different things that Justin would want to interrogate Yurik about.
Oh, fun.
At the retrial.
Excellent. Yeah. Okay.
many of which are not public information, but yeah, there's ample ground there to cover.
Oh, Colin, are you talking about the bombshell? Is that what you're talking about?
The bombshell is indeed one of those things, which if there's a new trial, the state should be very concerned because, yes, Justin, I believe, would subpoena Yurik. And there's some things that would come out that would very much change the way a new jury would look at Jay and the evidence.
And this is why as much as I would love for this to be resolved quickly and for Anand to be able to start his life, essentially, part of me can't help but hope that we do get to see a retrial.
Yeah, no, I actually feel the same way. And I feel the same way because even though I know it means maybe more time for, or if he can get out on bail and then we go to trial, I guess that's what I would want, so that he can be with his family, but then we all prepare for a trial, is because I just want to destroy everything that happened 16 years ago, and do it the way it should have been done back then.
Well, and it drove me crazy to see Adnan constantly being referred to as convicted killer gets new trial, because the judgment was vacated. He is no longer a convicted killer. Am I right?
Well, I mean, I guess that you can frame it that, you know, formerly convicted killer gets a new trial. But I would even accept that. I just want somebody to mention the fact that there's no conviction. So he is now returned to, you know, innocent until proven guilty. And nobody's really highlighting that. And so it's also confusing to people. They don't know what that means. They just think it means, and you know, one thing I keep seeing over and over, oh, it's like, oh, he's getting a new trial on technicality. And that's what's making me crazy, actually.
Yes, that is one of the things that drove me crazy about the convicted killer headline, is because it just smacks of that to me. And it's so not the case, obviously.
Right.
The depth of the case, it has been completely overturned, not the technicalities. It's exactly the opposite of that.
No, I was going to say, you know, the factual findings the judge came to goes to the heart of, like, what actually happened on January 13th, where it's not actually about technicalities. And on top of which, you know, people say that what you're talking about is your constitutional right as a defendant, right? It shouldn't feel like a technicality to be given, like, what was your due.
It's also not really a technicality. I mean, technicality is sort of, there was no search warrant, but they found the bloody knife in your house. This is, the incoming pings that were used to convict him were not reliable, and that's what AT&T said. The come-and-get-me call where Jay had been given a non-cell phone, the heart of the state's theory of the case, this was a kidnapping by fraud. He got the ride from Hay and had given Jay the phone to make the call. It couldn't have been the 236 call. It couldn't have been the 315 call. There was no come and get me call. I mean, this is as close to a finding of actual innocence as you can get. It is not at all similar to, oh, well, this is a technicality. It was some legalistic thing that wasn't done and wasn't crossed by the state. It's very much going to the facts of the case.
And I think Judge Welch has a best in his decision. He talks about the evidence there, and one of his footnotes at the very end states, I think as regards to Woronowitz's affidavit, and he says, well, this just adds to it. It's another thing that adds to the fog of uncertainty that shakes the court's confidence in the outcome of the trial. And I think that's a huge line that rebuts anyone claiming this technicality. Like, the judge is stating plain and clear, this evidence shakes his confidence in the outcome of the trial that happened back in 2000.
I've always wanted to know the story of how Susan found the fax cover sheet. I mean, it always just seemed like an interesting bit of minutia. And maybe I think I'm not sure if you did you tell it on the show at one point? I'm not sure.
I don't think. Yeah. Well, basically, speaking of documents on the floor, whenever I get like a new file, my first step when I'm going through it is just to organize it and to like put things into piles and to, like, even before I start reading, I just want to have everything like in an order, like here's what was sent then and there's response, rah, rah, rah. So it was kind of like one of the first things I saw when Rabia gave me the defense file, because I was just trying to lay out stuff on the floor in order. And I'm like, oh, here's a cover sheet. I'm going to read this to make sure I know the context of when it was sent, who sent it, what role it played in the discovery process. And I'm skimming down it, and it says, like, in bold and caps, incoming calls not reliable. And I kind of staffed. And I'm like, wait, what? And I remember forcing my husband to read it like several times. I'm like, does it actually say what I think it says? Am I imagining this because I want it to say that? Or does it actually say in black and white right there that the incoming calls are not reliable? And he's like, yep, no, it does say that. I'm like, it can't be that simple, right? And he's like, well, that's what it says. And it was not that simple. But it did kick off. And that, you know, it's much looking more into Warren's testimony and realize that this guy had never seen it either, because if he had, he would have known things he didn't.
So it sounds like you knew the significance of it right away.
I mean, it's pretty, in terms of like plain statements, it's pretty plain.
Yeah, you don't have to be a lawyer to understand what that means and why it's significant to this case. But, you know, I want to ask you, Susan, because I wasn't able to be in the PCR hearing, I was sequestered, specifically about, like, how the judge treats the state cell phone expert, Chad Fitzgerald, how he treats how Fitzgerald tries to get out of saying that this fax cover sheet applies to these records. There's some really strong language around that. I would love to hear your thoughts on it. And I'm sure it's really exciting to someone like you, because this is like you've been so deep in this issue.
It's an unforced error from the state, because they didn't need to do this. They just needed to have enough respect for the court and the system to actually do their research and prepare. And if they'd done that, this wouldn't have happened. And I think even separate from the merits of the case, separate from the facts here, the judge is clearly pushing back against what happened in his courtroom. He was not impressed with what he saw with a federal agent reversing himself and coming up with testimony that like was convenient in the moment, but clearly not something he believed on a larger scale. I mean, that was the closest you'll get to like it's not a personal attack. That's the wrong word entirely. Cause it was a very justified reaction to what happened.
Can you just explain to listeners what happened? Like how Fitzgerald was trying to deal with like the titling of these records called detail records versus subscriber activity report.
Basically Fitzgerald got complacent. And I'm sure when he testifies, he gets a call from a prosecutor somewhere, says, hey, we need assistance here. Can you do this? And he says, sure. He rocks up, does his thing, goes home. That's the only reason I can think of why this went down the way it did. And we know there was issues already from the start, because basically the first time he talked to Theroux was the same day that Theroux named him as the expert. So from the beginning, he was being presented as stating things or being able to testify to things he'd never actually looked at. And it sounds like before the hearing, like a couple days before, he picked the files up, looked through them, said, yep, that looks good. And if he had paused to consider there could be something at issue here, I think he would have done things much differently. Because by the end of the hearing, he was testifying like a normal expert. He was being thoughtful. He was being careful and accurate in his responses. He was not combative anymore. And he sounded like you would expect from someone who is trying to testify to explain technical matters. But it was too late by then. Because he spent the first day that he was testifying just showing that he didn't care enough about the system to actually do research before testifying about it.
I feel like you're being really generous, Susan, because I personally don't think it was a research issue. I think Fitzgerald knew that he had to somehow make the case for the state that this fax cover sheet is not for these documents, that these are different documents, and he was just making crap up. But
that's true, too. Well, he was going off of what Theroux told him. And what Theroux told him seems to be exactly what he argued in his briefing prior to the PCR hearing. I don't think it crossed his mind to, before the hearing, oh, maybe the prosecutor isn't telling me all the facts.
No, okay, but wait. Okay, the document is in front of him. It is on a projector, and all that's happening is that Justin Brown is saying, can you read the top of the document? What does it say? It said subscriber activity reports. I mean, so that level of, like, belligerence, like, you know, that's where I draw the line. I would, if he said, oh, okay, well, wow, I didn't know that's what that said because I hadn't actually done my research, it's one thing. But he was like, no, I don't know. I can't read. I don't know what he said.
Here's Judge Welch commenting on it. Agent Fitzgerald apparently finds the title of the subject page to be irrelevant in his analysis. Instead, what really matters to the agent is that subscriber activity reports contain, quote, type codes and, quote, blacked out areas. It's essentially saying he was engaging in semantic gymnastics. It's clear this document says it's a subscriber activity report. The disclaimer says subscriber activity reports, incoming pings are not reliable for location. And you're trying to bend over backwards to try to claim this is somehow not the right type of subscriber activity report.
There was this awkward and boring scene during the PCR hearing where Theroux, and it was just awkward because Theroux had Fitzgerald get up there off the stand and start highlighting these big blow-up posters he'd brought in. And it had like a kindergarten feel to it. He'd be like, can you now highlight the lines that have like threes in them? Okay, now highlight the lines with twos in them. And then, I mean, it takes a while to highlight that much text because they're big, big boards. So it's a weird sort of awkward scene. And the judge was very, very, what's the word? He didn't give anything away. Most of the time, I think once or twice he cracked a smile. But for the most part, his face was neutral at all times. But during that highlighting session, I was looking at the bench and I thought he looked very, very unimpressed by the whole performance. And based on the decision, that seems to be the case.
Robbie, I wanted to know if now that Adnan's story, your book is coming out, are you going to write a new chapter for it?
Oh, yeah. Can you is it too late to add more to it?
It kind of is a little too late. It actually has gone to print, but what we managed to do last minute was to add a little reader note with an update in the very beginning. And, you know, when it goes to print again with either like a paperback edition or if people order it enough, there'll be another printing, then we will make an addition to it. Sorry, guys.
Okay. I'm still ordering it.
Yes, please do order it. It's getting good reviews. And what I'm most excited about, honestly, with this book is the fact that Adnan made contributions to it. He not only just wrote for the actual book, but we also have like a lot of letters that he wrote over the years. I've had letters from him for 17 years. And it gives me a lot of pleasure that he gets to say what he wants to say in his own terms.
Well, it came out too late for your book to have the update, but in general, I would like to thank Judge Welch for the timing of the decision, because it worked out.
It's okay. I'll take it. It's okay. I don't care. The book is not a big deal. The decision is a big, big deal.
And it makes for a very fun July 4th.
Yeah. Also, on like the day the hearing ended, someone asked me when we get a decision. I said June. I don't know why. I kind of just made it up. But I was right.
We've got a lot of psychics in the house, by the way. So you know what happened? No, seriously. So people around the world, like all kinds of people have been like sending me like messages. Oh, I had a dream that he's at it. And what happened right before the PCR hearing was Bob Ruff sent me a message saying, I wasn't planning on coming to the PCR hearing, but I had a dream. And I dreamt that I was, we were all sitting in a room together and Anand came into the room and everybody's happy because he's free and we're hugging. And that Bob in the dream turned to me and said, see, we didn't even need Asia. And I forgot, he actually has sent me this message back in February. And then when the ruling came out, Bob sent me a message saying, see, I told you, we wouldn't even need Asia. But I'm still glad we have her because, you know what, we might need her actually.
And she's an important part of the puzzle. And she does, I mean, even though this ruling is not based on the Asia issue, I think she's still a critical factual component of the judge's ruling. Like, it's going to be indispensable to have that going forward.
It also makes it very tough, as I said before, for the state to argue against the importance of the cell tower pings, because that then would all of a sudden make Asia that much more important.
They're boxed in. The state's so boxed in right now. I mean, this decision really cabins what they can do.
I actually, one of my favorite tweets was from the purported, it's a comedy account, but Los Feliz Daycare. It does a comedy Twitter account. Supposedly, it's the tweets of a very PC Southern California parenting style daycare center. And they tweeted, "This is puzzling. The toddlers just simultaneously yelled, 'New trial for Adnan. We've been we've been hashtag screen free all afternoon. Are they tapped in?'"
That's an awesome tweet. I missed that.
One thing to point out is that this was obviously a effort of many, many individuals. I mean, I'd say it takes a village, but like that's kind of, I don't think villages are usually that big. But I am still super impressed with what happened at the PCR hearing because Chris and Justin did a phenomenal job of shutting down everything the state tried to bring forward. They basically made sure they were prepared on every front. So when the state tried to do things that, you know, may have looked good in the moment, but were technically not true, or I guess that means they're false, they were able to quickly shut it down. And I think that's reflected here in the state's that's reflected here in the court's decision, because the court understood exactly what they were communicating and what they were focusing on. And they didn't let the hearing get distracted by nonsense, which is, for me, it was frustrating because you have like this hearing going on and you have the Naraja up there and saying all kinds of things that you're like, okay, where the hell is that from?
Susan, do you think that's a tactic to just kind of like confuse people or just put so much stuff out there that things get foggy?
Absolutely. And that's a big part of what they're doing. And Chris and Justin didn't take the bait. They kept it simple. They pointed out where claims were being made that were not correct and then moved on. They, you know, that like, that's enough. Here's what we know. We can show it in one point. Let's not let him pick the battleground. And it paid off because it allowed the judge to focus on what truly mattered here.
Here's a question that actually I have been raised with me a couple times from interviewers. And that is whether, like, if we get a new trial, what would either the state or the defense like be able to, and would they want to do the testing on the DNA evidence? What do you guys think?
I'm sure the state will do it if it comes to that, because what else they got? And Justin probably would too.
Well, it makes no sense to me though that somebody would. I don't know. It just seems like such a moonshot that there would be anything usable on that. This was a bottle, an alcohol bottle that it was near the scene, supposedly, at the time. Is that where they got the DNA from?
Well, that's one to be good to test as well. But also just the other forensic evidence taken from the scene, like the fingernail scrapings.
And even some of the swabs taken from Hayes' body were not submitted for DNA testing. One question is whether that evidence is still in a locker somewhere, and you know if it even exists anymore. Nobody actually knows.
Or if after this length of time, it would still be viable as a test sample.
Yeah, I've talked to a few like forensic pathologists and experts, and they all seem to think there's likely not going to be anything there. So it's probably a dead end, but you never know.
Okay, the question that's been raised also is that what will it take to get the state to like actually reopen the investigation into her death?
Yeah, I mean, the answer is they're not going to investigate anyone else until the case is closed against Adnan, which would mean that either they drop the charges or there is a new trial and Adnan is found not guilty. If there's something otherwise, I know a lot of people have asked, well, what happens if he takes an Alford plea? Well, the answer is, in that case, the state's not going to be actively investigating the case. But if new information appears, we have maybe someone confessing or we have new evidence that points in the direction of a certain suspect, at that case, well, certainly they would, you know, take the bait and look into it. But barring the case being closed against Adnan, while this appeal is active, while a new trial is pending, they're not going to be investigating alternate suspects.
Now, can I ask you guys a question just in terms of, I would love for you guys to reflect on the magnitude of what you've done, because this is a pretty remarkable moment for a new medium in terms of podcasting. Obviously, Serial popularized investigation of the case, but you guys took it to another level. And I just want to say, as a listener, I have loved that you never pandered to the audience. You always assumed that we would understand these things. And I think what you've done is really incredible. Did you expect that when you started this?
Yeah, you know, I think when the idea was first floated to take basically, you know, as a foundation of this podcast, Susan and Colin's blogs, which they had been writing for a while, and to turn it into a medium that people might actually listen, because, you know, it takes a lot more commitment to read, like, you know, 40 pages of a blog than hear the story. And people are also used to hearing the story because of Serial. I honestly expected a couple hundred thousand folks might, at the most. I mean, and that's not a bad audience. So we didn't certainly expect the kind of really big reach of it. And I think one of the most amazing, but you know, Susan and Colin had already done a lot of the heavy lifting because they had found a lot of the stuff that we talked about in the podcast. But for me, I think one of the most amazing things about this experience has been, let Susan and Colin talk about it, but is the fact that, you know, as it was ongoing, other people reaching out to us and saying, can you look at my case? Can you look at my brother's case? Can you look at this? And season two, which our listeners will be listening to in a week, happened when an Innocence Project came to us and said, hey, can you look at this case? And that says everything about the level of Susan and Colin's ability to really, like, you know, dismantle a case.
Well, what I was actually mentioning was that this is a whole new way of dealing with these things. I think that journalism up to this point had a really hard time actually communicating the intricacies of court proceedings. But what you guys have done is allowed people to participate and really understand to a much greater depth. And I don't know that you guys understand what you've accomplished. I think this is going to be the model going forward for some really exciting stuff.
For me, I feel a tiny little bit vindicated because I've always felt that people are smarter than what a lot of media gives us. Like, Serial wouldn't touch the cell phone stuff in detail. They just said, oh, look, some experts said some stuff about it. They wouldn't examine the intricacies of the court system. And there's an assumption that people can't follow this or can't find it interesting. But it is interesting. Like, that's why we do it. And, I think the average person is severely underestimated by a lot of what's out there in terms of court reporting and stuff.
Well, I just want to say again, you've transformed my understanding of the court system. And I think, you know, obviously Adnan and a lot of other people owe you a great debt of gratitude. And, you know, we're looking forward to what you guys are going to be up to next. I also wanted to thank you guys for allowing me to be a part of this. I'm still getting my sea legs in terms of quoting things and dealing with things and asking the right questions. I swear it will be a little more fun in the future. It's a little, but by the way,
John, this is one of the smoothest episodes like ever.
You are severely overestimating our level of organization and like
competence. And Colin, I'm not letting you off the hook for the bombshell. That is never going to happen. I'm going to bring it up in every episode. Every time you're around, it will drive you crazy.
But John, here's the thing. There's actually more than one.
Oh, I know. I'm actually unsure which one you're talking about.
Yeah, there's more than one. Yeah,
and there's a new one. There's a new one we just learned about that Robbie has sent us. So
you're not making this better for me.
It will all come out.
If it doesn't, then I'll promise to leak it to you in a year from today.
Yes. Yeah. If it doesn't, you'll get this. Honestly, if it doesn't, I'm going to write another book. Screw that. All right, guys. It's been great. Thanks so much.
All right.
Bye, guys.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye. Guys.
I spoke to Adnan's mom and Yusuf after I heard the news. And as can be expected, they are, of course, thrilled. That night, my husband went to visit them, and he reported back that in all these years, this is the first time he's ever seen Adnan's father smile, laugh, but also talk about how difficult these many years have been for him. And by the time this show airs, I will probably have spoken to Adnan, but he's already conveyed his relief and happiness to Justin. Let me talk a little bit about that relief. What many people don't realize is that while it's been exciting and exhilarating to get worldwide attention to the case, we have all held the same fear. What if, after all this, it still doesn't work? But it did. Thanks to an entire world of people, from Sarah and the Serial team, to Susan, Colin, and all those who make Undisclosed possible, to our supporters in the Magnet program, you know who you are, to Justin and Chris, who killed it at the PCR, to the thousands and thousands who have donated to Adnan's legal defense, and the millions who have followed the story in depth here at Undisclosed. The story is far from over, of course, and as John mentioned, this ruling doesn't only impact Adnan. It impacts Hayes' family. I get a lot of messages in light of this new development that ask me, what about them? And to be honest, I don't know how to answer that question. I don't know why Adnan, his family, or any of us investigating his case are responsible to account to Hay and her family, despite our deep pain and empathy for them. As far as I'm concerned, the only people responsible for not giving Hay justice are those who prosecuted the wrong man for it. I really hope one day Hay's family and community realize this and that they're able to pull themselves away from the state of Maryland, turn around, face them, and demand to know why they got everything so wrong. In the meantime, I want to assure everyone that our investigation is ongoing. We are also gathering evidence to piece together what happened to Hay. One day you'll hear about it, and as the case proceeds through the courts, we will, of course, continue to cover that as well. Adnan is finally getting a second chance at justice, but as we all know, he is one of many. I hope you all come back and bring your friends next week as we launch Season 2 of Undisclosed. A new murder, a new defendant, a new mystery to unravel. Next time on Undisclosed.
Thanks for listening to a special, emotional, exciting edition of the Undisclosed Addenda. We hope you enjoyed the interaction between our new friend John Cryer and your old favorites, Rabia, Susan, and Colin. You're going to get a lot more of that same great conversation every Thursday starting on July 14th. John will be there, and the Undisclosed 3 will be there, sometimes, and sometimes not. Thanks to Stamps.com and Blue Apron for coming to our rescue as sponsors this week. Both of them came in at the last minute to help us put on the show, and for that, we are tremendously, tremendously grateful. Listeners, by supporting Stamps and Blue Apron, you are supporting Undisclosed. They enable us to make this program. Visit blueapron.com/undisclosed, sign up, and get 3 meals free with free shipping. Then, when you did that, go to Stamps.com and use our promo code UNDISCLOSED for a 4-week trial, plus a $110 bonus offer that includes postage and a digital scale. So, you know, hearing our opening theme come in behind Robbie's phone call was pretty special. It kind of reminded me of our very first episode. A bunch of people came together with a lot of emotion to make Undisclosed, and it feels like now it's come full circle. So for that, we'll thank Ramiro Marquez for that music and our photography. Gratitude to Christy Williams for the website and the infamous Baluki for our logo. Unsung Hero of the Week award goes to Karen Turner for audio production. Karen, we are so thankful to you for coming to our aid and producing this addendum. We could not have done it without you. Karen's going to help us with some of her other promo work for season two, so we'll probably be thanking her 20 or so more times before the end of the year. The mysterious Methil Telhan puts everything together for us behind the scenes. Methil, I hope I said it right this time. We haven't come up with a title for her yet, so for now, we're just going to call her Awesome. On behalf of the Undisclosed team, I want to say thank you. Thank you to our listeners. I wish we could thank each and every single one of our supporters in the credits of this show. You're not just important to us, you are vital to the cause for which we fight. You are more important than anything we could possibly express in a recording. Thank you. Please continue to reach out to us on Facebook and Twitter via our handle, Undisclosed Pod, and talk about this special edition of the addenda with the hashtag #FreeAdnan. Damn, it's not just a hashtag anymore, is it? It's the new reality. We're going to free Adnan. I'm Dennis Robinson, and we'll see you on July 11th for the Undisclosed Season 2 premiere.